So this is March 26, 2014. I'm Rick Hansen. And as you know, I've been exploring the Four Noble Truths, especially the second and third ones, in the context of evolution. And we've been kind of working our way along into the relationship territory. Or Jean-Paul Sartre famously put it, hell is other people. So in that context then, I want to take a look at the intersection of what's called attachment theory in psychology and craving and its end. And as a way into this material, I invite you to take a look at your important relationships today, the ones that are emotionally charged, particularly romantic mate-type relationships or longings thereof, or issues thereof, family relationships, just important relationships. And ask yourself kind of how you are in those relationships, particularly in terms of whether you feel comfortable, at ease, secure, basically speaking, or whether deep down there's often a tendency toward feeling insecure, perhaps with a quality to it of sort of grasping after getting supplies from other people, or perhaps insecure with a sense of you've got to stay really well behaved and don't ask for very much. And if you don't bother them very much, they'll kind of let you stick around. And then flip the other way. You might want to, again, as a way into this, a way to keep it personal rather than conceptual and like some, you know, lecture in psychology class. Flip it around. What do you do with other people? Again, especially in charged, important, consequential relationships, when they come at you with their wants. And, or if they distance from you. How do you respond to that? Okay? So as a way into this, just so I kind of have a feeling for how many people I might potentially bore with the first 10 minutes or so, how many of you have a background as a therapist or you're knowledgeable about attachment theory? Good, only a few of you. So start feeling really bored, you know, just, I don't know, think about your mother and your father and that'll get you going. Okay, so the short version of this is that we are, as you know, social animals, we're mammals. And John Bowlby, a British, I think, physician, began looking at the ways in which the children, the babies and the children of birds and mammals related to their parents, especially their key caregivers, which in most species is the mother. And then by extension, he began looking closely at how human infants related to their caregivers, both mothers and fathers, and the ways in which early experiences created fundamental paradigms or templates or models of relatedness that would then be enacted and brought into adulthood. So the really super summary short version of this is that as a human infant is born, and this theory is very rested in biology, it's very rooted in biology, that as a human infant is born, the human infant is representing knowledge about the world very much in the framework of self and world, or in the beginning especially, over here and over there, right? And in the process of this profoundly dependent infant, how many of you are parents? Okay. How many of you have ever been an infant? Only a fraction. That's really amazing how you just kind of jumped over that whole developmental stage, right? That's great. That's a good trick. So my point is, or what I'm getting at, is that, as you know, these little kids are so helpless. They come out, they're about that long. They're pretty clueless. They kind of know how to suck. That's about it, the first few days especially. and they need a lot of things. Kids, by the way, come out with various temperaments or needs. Some are even born prematurely. Some children are very sort of robust, resilient, easy. They don't need a lot. Other kids, for whatever reason, they're easily disturbed or sensitive. Maybe there's something kind of wonky in their digestion, they're colicky, and they have more needs. So in the fit between what you were like when you were 1 minute old, 10 days old, 10 weeks, 10 months old, the fit between you and your caregiving environment really had a lot of impact. It's designed to have impact. Neuronally, the brain is proliferating neurons early in childhood. Literally, it's growing something on the order of like, there are phases where it's growing about 100,000 neurons a minute. It's crazy. Structures being built, synapses, little connections that are not being used or pruned away. Tremendous period of time of organization. The brain triples in volume. Quadruples in volume, roughly the first 12 years of life. Extraordinary. No other animal brain on the planet, in terms of animals, grows so much over childhood. So during this period of time, we naturally need, as infants and as toddlers and as older children as well, we naturally need many, many experiences of feeling tuned into, cared about, responded to, and regulated by our caregivers. So you might think back on what you know of your own childhood, or remember of it, or can surmise about it, perhaps by watching your parents interact with your children. Quick story about that. When when Jan and I had Forrest, he was about 2 months old when my mom and dad came to visit, and neither of my parents had seen their first grandchild. And my mom bustled in. My mom's a very loving person, and she was no longer alive, fairly large, and she had big glasses and big earrings, and kind of an aircraft carrier of a bosom. So she picked up Forrest, propped him there on the landing stage, and with his face about this far away, and if you may recall, like a two-month-old has a hard time lifting his or her head up, she started gooing and giggling and talking to him like this. And fairly quickly, he shifted, and he was a very easy baby, from being really mellow to fussing and starting to cry. I sat on my hands, I bit my tongue, Jan stared in mortified horror, but she knew better than to say a word. After some 90 seconds, couple minutes of this, which is a long time for an infant to be upset, I said something like, hey mom, how about turning Forrest kind of sideways, normal way of holding an infant, I think he wants to be held in that way. And her first line was, oh, he doesn't know what he wants. That's a theory of parenting. Very common theory, what I was raised in, many people in this room were raised in, that infants are kind of blank slates. They don't have much, clarity about what they want. The job of adults is to sort of teach them what to want. Okay. And then I said to her, well, a few minutes until you came in and held him like that, he was doing fine. I think he knows what he wants. He wants to be held like this. And then she said, rule number two of parenting, oh, who cares what he wants? Rule number two of parenting. Okay? And I wasn't abused, it wasn't horrible, et cetera, but one thing I also learned, I did my dissertation on 15-month-olds, interacting with their mothers, 10 boys, 10 girls, including making a batch of cookies. And I was studying what happens in the intersection when young children and caregivers want different things. It's easy when everybody wants the same thing. Have you noticed that in your important relationships? But it's when we don't always want the same thing or don't understand where we are at with each other, that's where issues arise. So what I watched, I videotaped this, and then I spent hours and hours and hours and hours staring at the videotape, coding it very, very carefully, watching little things a few seconds at a time. Child's hand reaches out, brushed away. Child makes a signal, it's not caught. Or child's hand reaches out, can't get quite to the really neat wooden spoon or gooey batch of batter to make ginger snap cookies with, and mom moves a little closer, so it's within reach. This constant dance of attunement and responsiveness. Any single episode, presume, unless it's extraordinarily intense for better or worse, probably doesn't matter that much, but the gradual accumulation. Studies show that in the life of a toddler, the toddler's wants are thwarted or unresponded to about 20 times an hour. Think about that. Think about that in adult life. Every 3 minutes, something you want at work is shut down. Something you ask for in a relationship is ignored or refused or thwarted. That's intense. So it's in that larger context that lots of little moments add up. And in my personal experience, people tend to deny or minimize or even punish themselves for having normal interpersonal needs and longings, both as children and now as adults today. So part one here is to ground this dynamic around relationships and what I call the socialization of desire, you know, the training of wanting, and the, you know, the construction of the sense of self, is to ground that in nature, in biology. It's natural to have these needs. So you might ask yourself, what happened to you? And in terms of attachment theory, the outcome of all those myriad little interactions that were shaped a lot by the fit between your needs, whatever they were, and they were normal, whatever they were. They were what they were, especially when you're young, right? They're not your fault if you had needs. It's not to your credit that you had no needs. You know what I mean? It just was the way it was. The fit between your needs and what happened, depending on the nature of your parents, other issues, maybe there was a sibling with a lot of needs, and you just kind of got the short end of the stick because you were low maintenance, and everybody thought you were okay, right? Maybe you had health problems and you had more needs than many. Whatever it was, the result of that is to, by around 18 months, have established yourself in usually one of four ways of relating. They're all ways of relating. They're modes of attachment. They're fundamental patterns of relatedness. Three of them are the primary ones. The fourth is pretty unusual and extreme. So this is where, in attachment theory, they talk about the fundamental distinction between secure and insecure attachment. And there are different ways to quite reliably test for this in children as young as 15 months, 18 months. And the attachment classification of even an 18-month-old toddler is very predictive of where that person is 10 or 20 or even 30 years later. And also how they function in life, how they feel, how they handle relationships, and so forth. So secure attachment basically means that the relationship doesn't have to be perfect, but there's a fundamental feeling of confidence that if there's an issue, that it'll be received and understood and responded to reasonably well. And there's also this kind of internalized feeling that's the result of installing thousands of little interactive moments. There's this internalized feeling that I matter, I'm seen, I'm accepted, I'm prized. Okay? That's kind of the sense of secure attachment. The word secure sort of communicates it. There's a sense of being supported and held by the caregiving environment. Doesn't mean that you don't quarrel with parents or, you know, have issues or be mad or I can't believe you grounded me for smoking dope for breakfast, you know, whatever it was. You know, stuff comes up, but there's this bone-deep sense of security and stability and confidence in the relationship. Probably, you know, statistically it varies estimates, but probably about half the population of kids around age 2 or 3 would tend to fall into that category, ballparkish. And then there's the other category, insecurely attached, which tends to fall into two subcategories. You again want to ask yourself where you kind of fit. One type, to summarize a lot of stuff, is insecure anxious. Insecure anxious, okay? That's a kind of child who, to use the example of a kind of fundamental paradigm for assessing things, the so-called strange situation, it's that when the caregiver leaves the room for a few minutes and the child, the 18-month-old, is left alone in the room and observed, the child just kind of melts down. Where'd you go? Where'd you go? Where'd you go? Where'd you go? And there's all this scanning. And even when the child's with the caregiver, before the caregiver leaves the room, the mother or the father leaves the room, the child is kind of clinging to the caregiver and very vigilant about anything that would pry the kid loose. Securely attached child is in the setting, is in the room with mom or dad, and as you know, as a 18-month-old, kind of monitoring mom or dad, but playing over here, looking over there, playing over here, looking over there. Anxious, insecure, clinging, this kind of demanding quality to it. Mom leaves, let's say, breakdown. Mom returns, then it gets really interesting. There's this protest behavior, you know, that's intense. How dare you, basically. You know, woo, woo, woo. Caregiver tries to soothe the child. Child really clings, you know, bad mommy. And it takes a long time to settle down, okay? You can project that forward into adult relationships. And this shows up in subtle ways sometimes, but it's the fundamental dynamic. You know, monitoring the object the relationship object, monitoring, not really trusting that there's a constancy of that object, right? Really upset and displaying upset when there's some kind of separation, trying to stop the separation from happening. Don't go. Holding on. And then when the other person comes back and there's an opportunity for, Margaret Mahler called it rapprochement, you know, coming back, tuning in, settling down, you know, really hard to console, and lots of sort of punishing, in a way, from the child to the parent for the caregiver, the object of attention, for daring to separate. Okay. Then you think about the other style, insecure avoidant. This is more the child, parents, child come into the room, child just kind of goes off by himself or herself. You know, little looks out of the corner of the eye. Are you still here? But over here, very well behaved, playing with the blocks, right? Caregiver leaves the room, avoidantly attached child, doesn't even seem to notice. But if you hook that kid up with a heart rate monitor, galvanic skin response, like a lie detector, needle pegs, hits the bar, right? Whoa. Outwardly, very little sign of activation. Inwardly, ba-boom, spike of physiological activation, stress response. Caregiver is left, okay? Caregiver is gone. Child seems very settled, no problem. What me worry? Outwardly. Caregiver comes back. Child hardly notices the caregiver. Oh, you're back. Inwardly, whew, major change in physiology. Okay. The kind of parenting, typically, that goes with each one of those styles is a parent, in the first case, insecure, anxious, who's kind of flip-flops between gushy affection and sort of rejection or punishing or devaluing. Parent of the other avoidant, insecure, tends to be more dismissing, you know, just stay away. I remember watching this mother and 15-month-old interacting, and the child was, one did that whole pick-me-up thing, the little kids do, and I watched the mother, literally, next to this child, you know, about as far away as I am from Tom. You see so much when you watch the bodies. It's about the bodies. It's the animal body. What do the animals do with each other in the body, right? This far away, like this. And of course, Tom's about that tall. Ah! And the mom just, like this, just stared at him. That's dismissing. It's inert. One way to, a major way to dismiss is just to do nothing. It's not just push away, although that can happen in subtle ways too. The little hand gesture, tone of voice, but just inert, kind of indifferent. Yeah. So it's pretty intense to watch on the camera, you know. And again, I don't mean to flood you, but you might want to look to yourself, okay, do any of these fit for me? Or to flip it the other way, what do you do when that style comes at you? Right? It's worth looking at either way. Because then, to link it now to craving and suffering, in either one of these insecure styles, there is a lot of craving, right? There's the natural desire for closeness. There are the, now as adults, unfulfilled needs, unfulfilled longings, you know, that haven't been tended to, so they're still alive and well. And they show up in lots of ways in adulthood, in the ways that we are with people in important relationships, or that we are inside our head. Maybe outwardly we're well-regulated, we're well-behaved, we've got a good act, right? But inside, our own needle, whew, is really moving. Right? Or perhaps go the other way, there's certain kinds of people that really activate us. For example, if we tend to be avoidant, you know, distancing, and if someone comes at us and they want narcissistic supplies, they want to be prized, they want to be valued, they want to be praised, they want to be appreciated, maybe there's a little demanding quality to that, kind of insistent in eagerness, maybe even a little bit of a complaint in it. See the fit? That insecure, anxious person interacting with that insecure, avoidant person? Ugh. It's like, you know, whatever. Some kind of fingernails on a chalkboard experience. That avoidant person wants to get away from, doesn't understand that intensity of need, right? Pushes it away. That makes the insecure, anxious person more clingy, creates that pursuer-distancer dynamic. Different forms of craving. The craving of come here, and the craving for go away. Right? Craving. Still craving. So I'm going to wrap up in a moment and see what you think about all this, and I want to preserve a few minutes at the end for kind of a deeper comment. So I think this matter, now this matter of looking at our own patterning and thinking of this as a form of craving. You know, insecurity in relationship is a form of craving, including subtleties, or the way we respond to others when they kind of come at us is also a form of craving. Where are you at with this form of craving? Maybe you're really very far along and it's not that much of an issue, but for most people, and certainly for me for a long time, you know, it has been an issue. So the good news, and then I'll see what you think, is that there are many ways to work through this. And I think there are probably, I would say, some classic ones. And I'll name some of the classic ones. I think probably the big three or big four. First is to form what's called a coherent narrative about what happened. You know, I've known a number of people come into my office. You know, they start out, how are you doing? Oh, they have an issue of some kind. Okay, great. Let's get a sense of your childhood. Oh, I had a normal childhood. It was great. It's just great. Fine. We did this, did that. It was just great. Okay, fine. Then you start getting the history. Oh, wow. You were part of a family that you changed. You went to 20 different schools. A major source of attachment relationships isn't just the parents. It's the siblings and the peers. It's very important. What were the relationships with the peer group? People might have been securely attached to their parent. And also studies show that these are independent. You could be securely attached to your mom and insecurely attached to your dad or vice versa. And then you think about being securely attached to your parents, and yet in the schoolyard is a horror show. And you don't feel securely attached to them, right? Because again, remembering, the way we form social knowledge especially is self and other, or me and them, right? Okay? Maybe in the schoolyard, them were not reliable attachment figures. So one is to form a coherent narrative that tells the story about what really happened. That's very important. That makes sense. Make sense of it. A second one is to practice internal secure attachment through mindfulness of your own experience. Because if you give yourself that attuned quality of presence with yourself and acceptance of yourself, kind of in a warm-heartedness, a caring, a kindness, a friendliness toward your own experience, deep down in the emotional memory systems, the ancient social mammal systems, mammals arose around 200 million years ago. The roots of these attachment classifications go all the way back to the first little squirrels and rats climbing around on those trees at night because they were warm-blooded and could hunt at night. Right? So, anyway, yes. Deep down in those memory systems, if you give yourself those experiences of caring and presence and attunement and kindness, those deep memory systems don't know what the source of that experience is. And studies show, and people like Dan Siegel have done a really lot of good work on connecting the two, the giving ourselves this quality of mindful, accepting, attuned, caring presence, such as through meditation, or bringing that quality into everyday life, that can heal insecure attachment. Okay. A third is to repeatedly internalize secure attachment experiences today. Look for those little opportunities. Like I said, these are quick, 5, 10, 20 seconds at a time, when you're having a kind of resonant interaction with someone, you're tuned into each other, or you're feeling liked or included, or someone has sought you. You know that runaway bunny story you read to kids? The little bunny's telling the mom, the mother bunny, I'm going to turn into a fish and swim away. And she says, well, I'll become a whale and come find you. I'm kind of paraphrasing. He says, I'll turn into a bird and fly away. She says, that's all right. I'll become a wonderful eagle and I'll come get you. And goes through all this. We want to be sought. We want people to come looking for us. Kids love to play these peekaboo games. You know, or they hide. And the great British child psychiatrist had a great line, Winnicott, said, with regard to these prevalent games, which are really about being sought, it's about intensifying the experience of being pursued in a healthy way. As he puts it, a joy to be hidden, a disaster not to be found. Think about all the experiences you may have had. I had a lot of them, of not feeling found. Even in perfectly outwardly normal, decent, polite, well-behaved, not abusive family environments, or in school settings, or moving into puberty. How often did we feel appropriately found or wanted or sought in our dating experiences? That's a horror show. We could do a whole talk on those. Anyway, okay, so third way, internalize repeatedly experiences of healthy attachment today, in large and small, mostly small. Take in the good of feeling cared about any way you can find it, any port in a storm. A huge part of my own practice in life was to relentlessly going after, you know, a handful of times every day, experiences of feeling included, wanted, cherished, prized, and seen. To brick by brick fill the hole in my heart that felt as large as a construction site. And then the fourth main way, certainly these four really, really matter, is deliver your undelivered communications. Very often what happens is the protest feelings or the anger or the longings aren't really said. They can't be said often in childhood because the child doesn't have the words, or the words would be punished if they were spoken out loud. But they become undelivered, and then there's a pattern of undelivered communications today. You know, speaking from the heart, validating your own experience, obviously being skillful about it, you know, thinking about right speech and all the rest of that, and can this person really tolerate it? But at least knowing what your truth is and looking for as many ways as possible to speak it is actually a way to reestablish, you know, a kind of security in your own way of relating to the world. Seeds planted. So, what do you think so far about this? Any questions or comments so far? Yeah, in the back.
Basically, I was going to say this is very. I'm going to do it short and simple. But going back to on your listening to Carolyn Mace and Deepa Chopra about the detachment, letting go, projection, it all intertwines, and then in that when. Not everybody gets the proper upbringing, and of course, that develops into a variety of different things. When at our age, as we know and we begin to know ourselves more, and like Carolyn was saying, Miss was saying, you know, in the 60s, everybody knew what they didn't want, then it's like, what do you want? And you don't really know. I think for the most part, when you are a peaceable person and you want to attract that, you kind of feel the way through it, you know when people are projecting or somebody's being nasty, and it's best to just use it, like they say, nothing nice to say, don't say anything at all, and do what you're actually saying is taking the good, but also allow the good to come, not kind of dismiss the bad, but bring it out into the open, clarify it, gee, I feel you're doing this, I mean, because that's all a part of diffusing the shadow, pretty much, because you need a connection to diffuse the shadow, or you have these horrible, you know, history situations, and coming together and diffusing that and talking and trusting, even if you never can tell whether a relationship's going to come or go, that's not your power, but
yeah.
Being able to trust and diffuse is pretty much what's going to eliminate all the bad outcomes from previous, and that's why people evolve. So in that way, this is very good to be able to know that you strengthen yourself by relying on giving and giving.
Well, thank you for saying that, and I think part of what you're saying, for me, I want to invite you into this in a kind of very real experience near way, you know. In other words, what's it like for you to be with others, especially important, charged, intimate others? Flip the other way, what's it like for others to be with you? And as you were saying there a second ago, can we be with others in a way that creates a secure attachment experience for them that's appropriately bounded, in which we take care of our own needs and so forth? And for you, thinking about how it is for you to be with others, I really invite you to kind of bring it down to, what's my interpersonal craving? In the broad sense, the Buddha meant that word. Am I utterly centered, equanimous, compassionate, lovingly undisturbed, no matter what happens with others? Or, if you're like me, you're still a work in progress. What's your interpersonal craving? And one way to look at it, it's a nice map. It may not fit for you, but for many, many people, this attachment theory map is a very powerful way to zero in on your own personal interpersonal craving. And another question or comment? Yeah.
A question. Can you go over the four solutions?
Yeah, again?
Yeah,
from a practice standpoint.
From the title.
Yeah. Bullet points. Form a coherent narrative in which you make sense of it to yourself. Second, give yourself attuned mindfulness. Third, repeatedly internalize secure attachment experiences today. You can also do it retrospectively by rewinding certain relationships you had, friends, and regenerating the experience through memory, like, oh yeah, we had that deep conversation, I felt so tuned in, you know, but generally we do this internalization in present time, taking the good of healthy relationship experiences. And fourth, deliver your undelivered communications. You know, speak in a more coherent, integrated way, here and now. Name the taboo. Name the unnameable. Speak the longing. You know, express what's happening inside you. Obviously, do the best you can to do that skillfully. You know, speaking from the heart, staying in your own experience, practicing right speech, good guidelines. But look at your key relationships. What's unsaid? Maybe nothing's unsaid. You know, usually a lot's unsaid. And in the process of coherently tuned into yourself and sticking up for yourself, saying it, that's a deep healing too. It's like being in, you know, it's like one of the hallmark characteristics of insecure attachment is a breakdown of inner allies. There's not enough of an inner ally. There's not enough of an internalization of those who are on your side. So by sticking up for yourself today, in skillful, appropriate ways, et cetera, that's a way to really build up that sense of inner allies, by being an inner ally for yourself. Yeah.
And I don't know, my proneness is to want to take care of them, want to fix it. But that never works.
Yeah.
And all I can do is like love her, you know, and take pressure off of her. But I can't change how she's interacting with the world.
Yeah, that's right.
I can only do what I can do over here.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's great. Maybe another comment or question? Yeah.
Yeah. So I was raised in the 50s, and I'm just thinking back then with mothers and their relationships with their sons.
Yeah.
And how close they were allowed to be, and how fathers kind of looked at that. And just thinking that in the last, I don't know if it's been 10, 20, or 30 years, how that's probably improved as far as the mothers and the sons, or the fathers and their sons and their daughters. Physically, because I don't think in the 50s, I mean, it was really that accepted of really nurturing the boys anyway. And I just wondered if there have been studies on that.
There's some studies, and of course, you know, this attachment stuff has been examined in other cultures, so it's not just a Western phenomenon, you know. But the thing that I would really encourage you to look at inside is what's your interpersonal craving today? You know, for example, more the anxious, are you trying to make something happen? You know, trying to make something happen, or in my own, and some people are kind of a combo. That was interesting for me to realize. I was sort of a combo, because I think in some ways, I was raised avoidant, insecure, because I got to be with my mom as long as I wasn't a problem. And also, I think, too, knowing something about your personal history is often really helpful. She got pregnant when I was about 4 months old. What were my parents thinking? Anyway, and she apparently had a lot of morning sickness, so, you know, you just kind of can make up an accurate story. There I was about 6 months old, 4 to 6 months old. She was just feeling like crap, you know. My dad was off in grad school working really hard trying to finish up. You know, I'm sure I was kind of fended off. And I realized, oh, I got to be loved, I got to be okay, as long as I didn't ask for anything. That's the hallmark of avoidant attachment, you know. And so there was that. On the other hand, I was kind of whipsawed because my mom especially alternately said, oh, you're so special, Rick, you're so smart. And, oh, you did that wrong too. See what I mean, back forth? So it's kind of like value, devalued. So that left me kind of longing for those narcissistic supplies. So you can kind of have a combo. You can look to yourself. What might be true? Again, it's okay. We're just using 100 years, especially 50 years of attachment theory. this deep psychological model. We're looking at the Dharma through the lens of attachment theory. And we're looking at attachment theory through the lens of the Dharma. And bringing those two together and exploring, wow, what sparks could fly? How could we use this to surround our service in practical, down-to-earth ways? You know, and being more chill and stable and both equanimous and loving with others and getting our own needs met so that we actually clear out a major fuel for craving and unsettledness. Maybe one last person, and I'll make a comment, we'll wrap up. Yeah.
My question is about number four, delivering your undelivered communication.
Yeah.
Does it help at all to do that retroactively and without the other person actually being present?
That's great. I think it really totally does to deliver. And I think there are three levels of delivering communication. So first is to claim the truth for yourself inside your own head. Okay? That's huge for many people. Because the first casualty of insecure attachment is the truth. Because you're not allowed to comment. You're not allowed to say what's really going on. So, you know, reclaiming your personal truth is a really important part of the journey toward reestablishing this kind of, as many people do. The good news is you can do it. You know, I've done it, and a lot of people do it. A lot of research shows. So reclaim the truth to yourself. The second level of delivering communications is to another party. And you can do that in different ways. You can write it on a piece of paper, burn it. I've written letters to my parents I know was never going to send using my left hand, my non-dominant hand, with a crayon. F you! You know, getting it out, never going to send it, but, you know, there's a place, whatever. Or you speak it out loud, or you tell somebody, speak it to God, talk to a therapist. You know, you're working it. And if it's possible, to the person themselves, sometimes only in your own imagination. You know, if people are no longer alive, or just wouldn't be appropriate. They'd like have no idea. There they are, sitting there in the nursing home, and, you know, someone's just blasting them. Like, it's not going to happen, right? So, yeah. But to go back in retrospect, yeah. And not just to parents, but to think about, if you think about your own peer group relations, you know, going through grade school and then high school, imagine a scenario where the people that were really trouble for you are sitting there and they have to listen. Or even better, maybe there's some deep being in them who wants to listen, deeper than their personality. What would you want to say to them? If you could say it, what would you say it? And then can you imagine saying it in a way that feels wholesome and complete for you? In other words, you're working with things skillfully. We're using the skill set that was not accessible to the Buddha 2,500 years ago to help heal some of the disturbances that drive craving, that unsettled drivenness, you know, including or just getting away. By the way, avoidant attachment is in some ways the hardest to notice because it's so well behaved and it's subtle, you know, and you can watch it interpersonally around optimal distancing. Someone makes some kind of bid for closeness, what do? They share something from the heart, do you match them? Or do you make a little joke? Do you intellectualize? Do you subtly put them down? What do? Right? They want affection. Do you reciprocate at their level? Do you match their level? Or do you go one down, which is a signal, don't be a bother. You know? That's harder to watch, but it's really powerful to watch it. I became more aware of how I was creating subtle signals to other people where I had internalized my own dismissing parents. See? So that's another good thing to watch. Okay. So I have a final comment for you. I've got to wrap up just on time. I'll stick around a few minutes, then I've got to go. I'm going to pursue this, and next week I think I'm going to talk about something I know very well from the inside out, longing for narcissistic supplies. And what happens around that, and ways to work with that. So paradoxically, through the internalization of feeling, of experiences of feeling valued, increasingly you feel unconditionally worthy. You release shame and inadequacy, and you're not so off balance and craving organized, you know, in relationships. That's a big one. Okay. So I want to invite you into kind of a deeper way to look at this too. So what is the nature of secure attachment? What do we long for? What did we long for when we were, you know, 1 day old, a year old, 100 years old? What do we long for? Long for? Yeah, love.
Or
a sense that we're held.
Nurtured.
Yeah. So, great. Well, this is great. Okay, so now, right under our noses, see if it's true for you. It's okay if it's a little conceptual at first. See if you can bring it into your experience, because that's where it counts. Okay? First is, if you just pause, it might help to have your eyes closed. Be aware of your experiencing altogether. In other words, there's sounds that there's hearing going on, there's thinking going on, there's a sense of an internalized viewpoint, there's kind of this global sense of being a body. See if you can have a sense, maybe later especially, play around with taking your experience as a whole, recognizing that it's all experience. And at the level of it being experience, including awareness itself, the whole of it, no part left out, as experience, it's undifferentiated. You're opening into the whole of experience. That right there is a way to feel related and connected. That's just immediately available in the nature of experience, always right under our nose. That's an opportunity to feel securely attached no matter what has happened in the psyche. Then even deeper, the second level of this, and I'm just kind of naming this as something you might want to play around with. You might also have a sense of extending past your experience to nature and the physical universe altogether. And realize intuitively, wow, it's all one whole thing. And what's happening right here in this body is just one tiny little thread wiggling in the vast tapestry of the cosmos. There's just one whole tapestry. You're kind of opening out into allness. As much as allness, you're connected. You can explore that. And then, if it's at all real for you, the first two are obvious when you look at them. Experiencing them is a deepening matter. But you can recognize, if only for about half a second at a time, wow, that is true. Right? It's perceptible. The wholeness of experiencing and the wholeness of reality. It's possible, third, that you might have an intuition of what the Buddha called the deathless, the unconditioned, the way it languages for me is unconditionality, always just prior to the emergence of conditionality in each moment. You might have a sense of it as the divine, if that's real for you. If nothing else, some kind of mystery, always just prior to the emergence of reality. And again, if you kind of intuit opening out into that, you're always already at home there as well. Any one of these three, and they kind of deepen for you, are in a way our ground of prior connection and relatedness that is inherently secure by its very nature. And you can explore that increasingly, if you like, at a level that's even deeper than the more psychological kind of growth and healing and work I was talking about. How about we sit for about a minute, wrap it up. In other words, speaking to the last little part there, insecurity can be held in a deeper context of security, of connection, of relatedness. Both can be true. Thank you. Sorry for going a bit long.
Thank you.
See you next week.